non-Jews in a non-Jewish language. Canada is a good example. Until recently, its English-language Jewish writers, like Leonard Cohen, though unlike Mordechai Richler, have dealt with Gentile themes, its Yiddish writers with Jewish themes. The one country that flouts this rule is the United States. A specifically English-language Jewish literature has evolved here, next to a Yiddish and also a Hebrew literature. Nevertheless, even in its heyday, the American Jewish novel, whatever its worth, was derided as clannish by certain Jews and non-Jews. The post-World War II era has produced something of a German-language Jewish literature in Germany and Austria, but with only a few thousand German-speaking Jews left, the audience is chiefly Gentile. Franz Kafka went along with this skewing and masking of cultural subjectivity. He never once mentions the word Jew or Jewish in his fiction. Had he written about Jews, his audience would have been vastly reduced. After all, in his day, less than 1% of native German speakers in Germany and Austria-Hungary were Jewish. Like most Jews writing in German, say Hermann Broch or Elias Canetti or Ernst Toller, Kafka tended to depict explicitly non-Jewish, indeed often Christian, characters. Still, we can't be sure that these aren't disguises. Just as the names of his protagonists sound suspiciously like Kafka, for example, Samsa, and just as Rabban, being almost homonymous with German Rabe, raven, is a quasi-translation of Kafka, the Czech word for raven. The Jewishness of Kafka's themes and figures is open to interpretation. Persona, from the Latin word for mask, can, as in C.G. Jung, refer to the role that a person is playing in life. Take the filmmaker Josef von Sternberg. When he transformed Heinrich Mann's novel, Professor Unrat, into the film The Blue Angel, the director had a hidden agenda in delineating the authoritarian German high school professor. As he explains in his memoirs, Fun in a Chinese Laundry, the film character was partly suggested by a Hebrew teacher under whom von Sternberg had suffered as a boy. Not so dissimilarly, when Kafka wrote The Judgment in an all-night session, he composed it, according to his diaries, on the eve of Yom Kippur, the Jewish Day of Atonement, which is also known in Hebrew as Yom Hadin, the Day of Judgment. It is such secret itineraries, conscious or not, that make art less than universal, more than parochial, leaving it open to multivalent readings that may unearth an intrinsic, and perhaps necessary, closetiness. Still, like the Oscar Wilde heroine who dons a beautiful mask, which then becomes her face, the underlying strata are finally replaced by the surface disguise. Albert Einstein, who spent some time in Prague, left us with a modern metaphor for that phenomenon when he described our physical world as the three-dimensional surface of a four-dimensional universe. On translating. No matter how much space can be devoted to a stylistic and linguistic analysis of any writer, at least twice as much would be required for investigating a translation. Along with the discussion of the original text and the English text, we would have to delve into the actual migration from one language and culture into another. Let me therefore limit myself to focusing on a couple of facets which I hope will show the confusions and complexities of any translation. Naturally, and the nature of nature. Natürlich, both adjective and adverb, is a normal, indeed fairly bland and bromidic word in German. It means naturally, of course, by all means, sure, needless to say, etc. As an interjection, a concession, it goes almost unnoticed. Yet it conceals an intricate reference to cerebral and behavioral manipulation by Western culture and religion. During the 19th century, as traditional absolutes were being replaced by new, usually scientific and technological absolutes, but also by numerous relatives, the concept of nature and natural changed in meaning and power. Often the word divine was replaced by natural. Nature, says Catherine Hepburn in The African Queen, is something we were put on this earth to rise above. For Christianity and European civilization, nature has always been something to be overcome, conquered, tamed, domesticated, subdued, and subjugated for human use. The West draws an artificial line between nature and human or man-made, as if a beaver's natural dam and an engineer's technological dam were not subject to the same physical laws, the same natural laws. After all, whether you jump off the Jungfrau or the Eiffel Tower, you are prey to the same law of gravity and you will fall at the same speed. Naturally, this ancient distinction between natural and man-made gives Homo sapiens a special place in creation, and the privilege of bending Mother Nature and her children to his will. In an inconsistent yet compatible fashion, the natural was also seen as quite the opposite, an ethical imperative, not only in natural law, which nevertheless changes from culture to culture and era to era, but in human conduct. While religion and government attacked some forms of behavior as being natural, they lauded others, likewise as being natural. For instance, men's domination over women, whites' domination over blacks, Europe's domination over the rest of the world, the nuclear family, family values, etc. To confuse things further, unnatural has always been a put-down, no matter how good or bad, the natural. In the United States, books and movies about the Wild West summed up this process as the subjugation by men of land, nature, and savagery, a process that was then complemented by the arrival of women, who brought Christianity, culture, refinement, breeding, in a word, civilization. The cataclysmic upshot of this citing of natural and unnatural as ethical standards was European fascism, which, in touting nature and natural man, yet deploying the most destructive pre-nuclear technology in history, set up life and death categories. The Nazi government even tried to change nature's name, Natur, into the more Germanic and therefore more natural, Allmutter or Werdemutter. Rather than letting Darwinism and evolution take their alleged natural course, fascism, unnaturally, lent Mother Nature a helping hand. Anything and anyone that a fascist state declared unnatural was segregated and ultimately killed. In Kafka, the protagonist often has to pay a terrible price when, willingly or not, he goes against nature. Not only by turning into a bug, Gregor Samsa, but also by, say, abandoning both his child and his parents, Karl Rossmann in The Stoker, or betraying his father, Georg Bendermann in The Judgment. Ultimately, nature takes its, or her, toll, and the punishment is no less severe than the ones meted out by vengeful deities in Greek tragedy. Kafka may assault and expose the nuclear family and its destructive patriarchal basis, yet he longs to restore it, to give the punitive father his natural place. Rossmann, orphaning his unborn child and orphaning himself by leaving home, seeks both father and family in the new world. Samsa, by dying, reestablishes the natural order of domestic things. Bendermann, by carrying out his own death sentence, restores his father to power. Now, as a rule, one might render natürlich not necessarily as naturally, but as of course, or needless to say. However, given the tradition that Kafka was working in and against, I've translated this adverb as naturally throughout. I have no choice. This innocent-looking word encapsulates a crucial pattern in Western and Kafkaesque thinking. Tense and aspect. In its verbal structure, English, like the Romance and Slavic languages, divides motion and being into perfective and imperfective aspects. I go versus I am going. I went versus I was going, etc. In an English narrative, the action, the bare bones of the plot, are rendered with the perfective tenses, while the background is filled in with imperfective tenses. This development in European languages seems to have begun at the same time as the introduction of spatial and mathematical perspective into European art. Verbal, tense, and artistic perspective divided reality into foreground and background. Thus, a piece of fiction usually begins with an imperfective verb by way of introduction. I was sleeping. Then, shifting into a perfective verb, the narrative launches into the plot. I woke. German verbs make no such distinctions. The noun imperfect, applied to the simple past, that is, preterite, is an inaccurate borrowing from Latin and Romance terminology. It's best ignored and replaced with praeteritum, preterite. In a German narrative, foreground, plot, and background are distinguished by the syntax. The often Ciceronian sentence tends to devote main clauses to the plot and relative clauses to the background. Of course, given the multiple, often myriad, and sometimes even contradictory tasks of each grammatical element, this division of labor is never entirely strict. As a result, hypotaxis, or syntactic subordination, has a very different role in German, which clearly marks each subordinate clause not only with commas, but also by shifting its verb to the very end, so that we can easily tell which clause is describing foreground and which background. Once again, this assignment of linguistic tasks is not always rigorous. Similarly, whenever German offers a quick string of very brief sentences or main clauses, English would tend to subordinate some of them as present participles, which German seldom uses to introduce clauses, limiting participial clauses to extremely lofty, highfalutin diction. Confronted with the cat's cradles and Chinese boxes of German clauses, the American translator has to figure out when to use perfective, imperfective, or participial verbs in English. You have to decide if a German clause or sentence, German uses the same word, Satz, for both concepts, is foreground or background, superordinate or subordinate, or somewhere in between. Kafka learned Kleist's lesson about the anxiety created by intricate hypotaxis and the suspense of waiting for the verb to drop like the headsman's axe at the end of a long and harrowing sentence. Hard to duplicate in English. In the first sentence of the Metamorphosis, Die Verwandlung, the reader slides through the casual tone, confronts the words ungeheuren Ungeziefer, monstrous vermin, and finally crashes into the concluding past participle verwandelt, transformed, which ties the whole sentence together, telling us what has happened to Samsa and explaining what the title means. Als Gregor Samsa eines Morgens aus unruhigen Träumen erwachte, fand sich in seinem Bett zu einem ungeheuren Ungeziefer verwandelt. Literally, as Gregor Samsa one morning from agitated dreams awoke, found he himself in his bed into a monstrous vermin transformed. That final and ineluctable past participle, verwandelt, transformed, is horrifyingly relentless. It makes the sentence and the story. Incidentally, Ungeziefer means vermin, not insect, which is either Insekt or Kerbtier in German. And while the adjective ungeheuer means enormous, the noun ungeheuer means monster. Like Kleist, Kafka piles on the prepositional phrases to increase the tension. But in English, as opposed to German or French, a sequence of even two prepositional phrases can sound clumsy, and adverbs tend to be discarded in favor of adjectives, all of which make for syntactical headaches in a literary translation. One morning, upon awakening from agitated dreams, Gregor Samsa found himself in his bed, transformed into a monstrous vermin. He lay on his hard, armor-like back, and when lifting his head slightly, he could view his brown, vaulted belly partitioned by arching ridges, while on top of it the blanket, about to slide off altogether, could barely hold. his many legs, wretchedly thin compared with his overall girth, danced helplessly before his eyes. The hermeneutics of translation are individual. Each approach is subjective, selective, and no single interpretation, however valid, holds the unique and absolute truth. Equally decent translations may exist side by side. Another translator may reassign the perfectives, imperfectives, and present participles in altogether different patterns to form a different arrangement of foreground and background, shading the narrative in a different way. While there are many possible mistranslations, there are only a few possible correct translations, each one constituting a variation of the original theme. The trick is to find a cohesive and coherent variation that replaces the original theme for the new reader who, having no access to the foreign language, must take the translation as a primary text. While it would be exciting to dig into all the strata involved in translating Kafka, I'd rather let the translation speak for itself. Acknowledgement. I am deeply grateful to my editor, Erica Goldman, for her patience and for her thorough and sensitive editing of my translation. Joachim Neugruschel, New York, November 16th, 1992.
And now, a collection of three of Kafka's early stories, beginning with Conversation with the Worshipper.
There was a time I went to a church, day after day, because a girl I had fallen in love with would pray there, kneeling for half an hour every evening, when I could watch her in peace and quiet. Once, when the girl had not come, and I was glaring at the people in prayer, I noticed a young man who had thrown his scrawny figure full length on the floor. From time to time, he would grab his skull with the full force of his body and, moaning, smash it into the palms of his hands, which were resting on the stones. The only other churchgoers were a few old women, who often turned their kerchiefed heads sideways to peer at the worshipper. This attention seemed to make him happy, for prior to each of his pious outbursts, he would glance about to see whether the onlookers were numerous. Finding his conduct unseemly, I resolved to accost him when he left the church and to question him about why he was praying in this manner. Yes, indeed, I was annoyed because my girl had not come. However, he did not stand up until an hour later, crossing himself very meticulously and trudging unsteadily toward the font. I stationed myself between the font and the door, knowing I would not let him pass without an explanation. I pursed my lips, as I always do when I intend to speak firmly. I put my right leg forward and leaned on it, while casually poising my left leg on tiptoe. This, too, makes me resolute. Now it was possible that the man eyed me when sprinkling the holy water on his face. Or perhaps he had already noticed me earlier with some anxiety, for now he unexpectedly dashed outside. The glass door slammed shut. And when I promptly went outside, I could no longer see him, for there were several narrow streets and the area was thronged. He did not show up again during the next few days, but my girl did come. She was wearing her black dress with the diaphanous lace on the shoulders, the crescent of the chemise neckline showing underneath, and with a nicely cut silk bertha hanging down from the edge of the lace. And, since the girl had come, I forgot all about the young man. Nor did I concern myself with him even later, when he started coming regularly again and praying in his usual style. However, he always hurried past me, averting his face. Perhaps it was because I could only picture him in motion, so that even when standing still he appeared to be skulking along. One evening, I dawdled in my room, but then I went to church after all. I did not find the girl, and I was about to go home when I spotted that young man lying there again. The old incident crossed my mind, piquing my curiosity. I tiptoed over to the doorway, handed a coin to the blind beggar sitting there, and squeezed in next to him behind the open wing of the door. I sat there for an hour, perhaps with a cunning expression. I felt fine and resolved to come here often. During the second hour, I found it absurd to be waiting there for the worshipper. Nevertheless, growing angry, I sat for a third hour, letting the spiders crawl over my clothes, while the last few people, breathing loudly, quit the darkness of the church. Then he came too. He walked gingerly, his feet cautiously testing the ground before treading. I stood up, took a large, straight step, and grabbed the young man. "Good evening," I said, clutching his collar and pushing him down the steps to the illuminated square. When we reached the bottom, he said to me, in a completely unhinged voice, "Good evening, my dear, dear sir. Do not be angry with me, your humbly devoted servant." "Well," I said, "I want to ask you some questions, sir. Last time you escaped. Today you will scarcely succeed. You are a compassionate man, sir, and you will allow me to go home. I am to be pitied, that is the truth." "No," I shouted into the din of a passing trolley, "I won't allow you. This is the sort of encounter I like. You are a lucky catch. I consider myself fortunate." Then he said, "Oh God, your heart is alive, but your head is a block of wood. You say I'm a lucky catch. How lucky you must be. For my poor luck is one that teeters. It teeters on a thin edge, and if anyone touches my poor luck, it will fall on the questioner. Good night, sir." "Fine," I said, clutching his right hand. "If you won't answer me, then I'll start yelling here in the street. And all the shop girls who are now coming out of their shops and all their sweethearts who are looking forward to seeing them will come dashing over here, for they'll think that a cab horse has collapsed or that something similar has happened. Then I'll make a public display of you." He now tearfully kissed my hands, alternating between them. "I'll tell you what you wish to know, but please let us go over to that side street." I nodded, and that was where we went. However, the darkness of the street, with its widely separated yellow streetlight, was not dark enough for him. Instead, he led me into the low hallway of an old house, under a tiny, dripping lamp that hung in front of the wooden stairs. There, he self-importantly pulled out his handkerchief, and spreading it on a step, he said, "Do sit down, my dear sir. This way you can ask your questions more easily. I'll remain standing, so I can answer more easily. But please don't torment me." So I sat down, and squinting up at him, I said, "You are an utter lunatic, that's what you are. How can you behave like that in church? It is so annoying and so unpleasant for the onlookers. How can people feel devout if they have to look at you?" He was pressing his body against the wall. Only his head was moving freely in the air. "Don't be annoyed. Why should you be annoyed at things that aren't relevant to you? I'm annoyed at myself when I behave imprudently. But if someone else behaves imprudently, then I'm delighted. So please don't be annoyed if I tell you that the goal of my life is to be looked at by other people." "What are you saying?" I cried, much too loudly for the low hallway. But then I was afraid my voice would weaken. "Really, now, what have you said?" Why, I can sense, indeed, since I first laid eyes on you, I have sensed what sort of condition you are in. I'm a man of experience, and I'm not joking when I say that your condition is a seasickness on dry land. It is such that you have forgotten the real names of things, and in your great haste you now pour random names upon them. Hurry, hurry, but the moment you run off, you forget your names for them. You called the poplar in the fields the Tower of Babel, for you did not know or did not want to know that it was a poplar, and now it is swaying again without a name, and you would have to call it when Noah was drunk. I was a bit stunned when he said, "I'm glad I didn't understand what you said." Annoyed, I quickly said, "The fact that you are glad shows that you did understand." "Of course it does, my good sir. But you, too, spoke in a bizarre way." I placed my hands on a higher step, leaned back, and in this almost unassailable position, which is a wrestler's last resort, I said, "You have a strange way of wriggling out of a predicament by assuming that other people suffer from your condition." These words lent him courage. He folded his hands together in order to make his body compact, then said, a bit reluctantly, "No, I don't act this way with everyone, for instance you, because I can't. But I would be glad if I could, for then I wouldn't need the attention of the people in church. Do you know why I need it?" This question left me perplexed.
Lost a thousand times, following the wrong design. some moral fabric to wipe up the lust. To wipe up the lust.
Yeah. We fight to the death under a crimson sky. no grammar in it, now then, wait. Winter paints it white. Yellow, black, and blue, and green, and brown, and no grammar in it, now then, wait. Winter paints it white.
Festival 2018 presents 2 days of adventurous music, challenging films, homemade slow food, and a dedicated record fair. Come down to the studio in the heart of Antwerp on Saturday the 25th and Sunday the 26th of August as of 3 p.m. For more information and tickets, go to soundinmotion.be. Enjoy the little summer bummer audio teaser we prepared for Gonzo Circus Mixcloud Monday. We'll be right back.
Thank you.